Thundergrunt.
Again, introduce yourselves.
I am Jimmy George. I am a full-time script consultant and a screenwriter.
I am Jamie Nash, a screenwriter and writer of the 44 Rules of Amateur Sleuthing, now available on Amazon.
Hell yeah.
And I'm Bob Rose, at Thundergrunt Bob on Twitter, and I'm the guy that everyone sends their Bill and Ted news to on Facebook.
That's the truth.
Every time there's new Bill and Ted news, they tag me in it. They send it to me privately. I get bombarded with any new news.
But what's the point of bringing that up? I don't get it.
Well, Jamie, if you didn't know, the movie we're talking about today is Fargo. No, the movie we're talking about today is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which, whoo, boy, yeah. This is like, you know how we always talk about Back to the Future kind of being the gold standard?
Yeah.
Like, one day we're going to talk
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, I've held off on that, putting it on the list.
To me, this is like just a few notches under. This is like that high on my totem pole. Because my favorite movie of all time is Bogus Journey.
Which I just learned.
I thought you knew that. No. Yeah. You're literally in a house right now with three framed posters of that movie. That's how much of a fan I am. But we're going to talk about Excellent Adventure, yeah. Not that.
Which is having its 30th anniversary in a few years.
Yeah, it's my favorite Alex Winter movie.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Aren't there probably only like a few?
Yeah, but Bob probably would know.
I mean, Freaked.
Freaked, yeah.
Love Freaked.
I guess Lost Boys kind
Lost
of counts.
Lost Boys.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
No, well, I don't know. Lost Boys would be up there. But
he's really a minor character.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
This is,
but he commands the screen when he's there.
He's also directed movies, too.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
He's a sure. great filmmaker
that's,
in
that's,
his own right.
That's so. Kind of what I've heard of about him.
No, you should see his documentaries.
He's awesome.
But we're not going to talk about
Dark
those.
Web one.
Dark Web. And
yeah,
he did one about Bitcoin. And everything.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah. He's probably got three of my top 20 movies, maybe 50 movies.
Really?
Probably three of them.
What would that be? The Bill and Ted's?
Bill and Ted's and Lost Boys.
Okay.
We'll count it.
I did not know that. I love Lost Boys.
Yeah, I'm a big Lost Boys.
You didn't know
fan
that he was in Lost Boys?
That he had, that Jamie was a
fan.
Oh,
Jamie was a fan
huge,
of Lost Boys.
I'm a huge Lost Boys fan.
Oh, my
Boys.
God.
We could do a Lost Boys episode
I would love
at some
to do
point.
That.
But today we're not doing that.
No,
today,
we're doing Bill and Ted.
We're doing Bill and
three,
Ted's Excellent Adventure.
There are three posters of Lost Boys in my house. If you can find them.
There might be.
There might be.
Jamie.
Yes.
What's the box office on Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
Box
1989,
office
right?
For mm-hmm. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, February 17th, 1989 was the release date. So kind of a dumping ground back then,
yeah,
for movies. And still a
kinda
little bit.
Still.
It's better now. It's more of a year-round schedule, I think, than it used to be. But
man, they showed them.
Yeah.
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 Right?
Yeah. $40 million domestically. They don't have foreign...
this is 89, too.
89.
So 40
yeah,
million.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
40 million.
Good.
That's really good. Yeah. Yeah.
And I should do what I always do and look up 1989. I'll do that.
Yeah,
because
Batman's on there. That was the
see
year
where, it fits.
Where I think Harry Met Sally was on that list, too. That's why
I
picked it for this year.
I think
year.
We did, yeah.
We're
going
to be doing a lot of...
Batman.
99. Yeah. 2009
anniversaries, yeah. Anniversaries, right?
So it comes in at number 32 for that year.
Okay.
Okay. So just to give you a feel, 32 is right before The Karate Kid Part 3.
Wow. At the same time as that. That's so weird.
That's really weird.
And yeah, right after Three Fugitives, which was the sequel to The Fugitive, where they're... No, it
wasn't. I love Three Fugitives.
Three Fugitives?
Yeah.
Some yeah other movies.
That's the Nick Nolte movie you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
So some other movies ahead of it. K-9, Always,
yeah.
Black Rain. Always was a big movie
yeah
in 89. I remember when I saw it. I'm surprised it was this far back, actually.
The movie Spielberg's known for, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez, yeah.
Right.
Major League, Star Trek V,
wow,
Final Frontier, The Abyss at 24.
Wow. It's weird to think of
actually
a Cameron
movie I actually
that
can't
low
believe Bill and Ted was that low. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's surprising me. But there's some big movies in front of it. Like, I mean, The Abyss is 24, and that's
yeah
that was like a huge movie.
Yeah, Batman's on
Pet
the
Cemetery. Sea of Love, a kind of classic.
Yeah.
Harlem Nights, Tango and Cash, Field of Dreams, Uncle Buck, Born on the 4th of July, Turner and Hooch, Christmas Vacation, God, Steel Magnolias, The Little Mermaid, War of the Roses, When Harry Met Sally, Dead Poets Society, Parenthood, Driving Miss Daisy, Ghostbusters 2, Back to the Future 2, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Look Who's Talking, Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones, Last Crusade, and Batman.
This still my beating heart. Oh, my God.
What a year.
Is like right prime in my life. Yeah. You know, wow. Yeah.
Tune in next week when Jamie reads a list of top 10 television shows from 1976.
We Didn't Start the Fire in the background.
Yeah. Harry Truman, Batman.
Right. Oh, my gosh. There's like maybe one movie on there I don't like.
Yeah.
Everything else.
Adore. Really.
The movie Bob doesn't like is Back to the Future Part 2.
Yes, I hate it. Honestly, it would probably be Driving Miss Daisy.
I've never seen, that's the one movie on this list I've never seen. I've never seen Driving Miss Daisy.
I did. That's not a fan. What's the story
behind it? You guys know.
I mean, obviously, yeah. I know. Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson.
Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson. Ed Solomon is one of these great, like, Yoda writer guys. He goes to the Austin Film Festival every year. I actually saw him early in my writing journey. He was at the Austin Film Festival, mm-hmm. and I sat in. He was, like, the guy. Like, he was the coolest, because he was doing Men in Black at the time. And as I've said before, if I had one genre I could do, it would kind of be this genre. It'd be the Bill and Ted, the Galaxy Quest, the Men in Black, Ghostbusters. If I could pick, this is where I'd be. I can't pick. They pick for me.
I not just doing that, but like he might be my favorite Twitter guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he is so interactive on Twitter with his fans and everything. Follow Ed Solomon on Twitter because he's been releasing Bill and Ted script pages and stuff recently. It's great.
Yeah.
It's just really great.
Excellent.
And where I was with him, so Chris Matheson, we'll go through him first. He's actually the son of Richard Matheson, I Am Legend fame.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's
who he is. And in fact, I think Bob might know this, but I think Bill and Ted, Richard Matheson even had a hand in Bill and Ted, like in that he said, like, you should do that as a sci-fi or something. There was some story I heard.
Spark.
I don't remember.
It was
basically
like he was pitching it to his dad, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm thinking." And his father kind of. It wasn't so much he came up with the idea as he said, "Yeah, you should do that." You know,
he was the encouragement factor. Yeah,
I think I heard that in like an N. Solomon panel once.
I wasn't there.
You weren't there.
I wish I was.
I just knowing the trivia of it all, I thought maybe you might know. But I know more about Ed Solomon than I do Chris Matheson. That's just the reality of it. Chris Matheson doesn't have as many credits outside of this. I think he had a couple things.
A
Goofy Movie or something.
Yeah, that they both wrote Mom and Dad Save the World.
That's right, Mom and Dad.
Which is a movie I adore. I love that.
Yeah,
movie.
Which seems like they got they got that gig almost directly off of this.
Off of this, and people were kind of hoping for the same type of box office.
Same kind of magic.
Yeah.
So what I know about Ed Solomon, and so for me, I grew up, I saw this when I was a senior in high school, and the things I loved most when I was a senior in high school were movies like this, and this was probably my favorite of that year, though I did love Batman a lot. I was into Batman.
So like fantastical sci-fi fantasy.
I loved Tim Burton.
Comedy.
Yeah. You know, there were certain things, but the other thing I really loved and I saw a couple times was Gary Shandling. Okay. And,
dude, I would get a tattoo of Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
That's how much I love
him. So, the Gary Shandling show was huge for me around this time. It was like, you know, the thing I loved. You know, I loved Gary Shandling. I loved the Gary Shandling show.
They were writers.
And Ed Solomon was a writer for the Gary Shandling show. Before that, he got his start in Laverne and Shirley, which is a show I watched every week.
What a career.
Yeah.
He lists his best stuff on his Twitter description, like it says it's Gary Shandling show.
Oh really?
It does. Men in Black and all that stuff.
So he became great friends with Gary Shandling. He was kind of in like a stand-up comic mix. He was doing a lot of stuff. He started to write jokes for Gary and things like that, and then he got a gig on the Gary Shandling show, and he had a great relationship with him apparently for years to come until Gary's death. So somewhere between Laverne and Shirley and this, he kind of had this dark night of the soul where he wasn't sure. Like, I think he stated that Laverne and Shirley was almost too early for him to get a gig like this. Okay. You know,
yeah.
Like he got it like right out of college, and I can't remember if he went to UCLA or I think it was UCLA that he went to, but it could be USC. I'm sorry, UCLA, USC people. But I remember he didn't get into the film school, so he was in the theater department,
mm-hmm.
And he was writing plays and things like that. But Bill and Ted was actually, and this is a part you probably know, him and a bunch of friends, they used to rent out a theater to do improv for each other.
Yeah.
Whoa.
They didn't do it for a crowd.
This story's on, I think, on the DVDs.
Okay.
The new Blu-ray set you can get from Shout Factory.
Okay.
Yeah. They talk about this a little bit. Yeah.
And that was probably another thing I was really into at the time was improv. So this guy was like my god. When I saw Ed Solomon, I was like, wow, he's everything I wish I could be. I want to be that guy when I grow up. So they did these two characters, Bill and Ted, for this improv that became like a regular thing Chris Matheson and him started to do.
Okay.
If I remember right, there was a third person. It was like Bill and Ted and somebody else.
Yeah, there was something.
The other guy dropped out.
Literally, it could have been a three-person dude. It could have been a trio, but the other guy was like,
So then at some point they
Where's that guy now?
Yeah, yeah, right. That's
great. Yeah, at some point during this Dark Night of the Soul after Laverne and Shirley, I think they got together, Chris Matheson and him, started to write a script. Came up with the idea, whether or not Richard Matheson said, that's a great idea, or whatever.
And it's also really funny, too, if you've ever heard about Gary Shandling, he had the same like Dark Night of the Soul about Sanford and Son, because he worked on Sanford and Son.
That's right.
And then he was like, I'm going to become a comedian. And then he did. Yeah. So oddly, his like protege had the exact same type of deal. Yeah. That's really weird.
It could just
really
be the writer's hero's journey.
Right.
Yeah,
you started sitcoms, then you decide. You make the decision.
So they wrote the script. I can't remember his agenting situation or stuff, but you know, being he was already a Hollywood animal, I think he had an agent. They sold the script, and this is the part I was interested in talking just business wise. When I say they sold the script, because I use this terminology a lot. A lot of times, what the sale is, they get a certain amount of money, and I can't remember how much they got for an option, and it's usually a very low amount. Nowadays, it might be $5,000 for a WGA option. Maybe it's $7,000, $10,000 might be a high-end option. If you're Stephen King, you might get $100,000.
Yeah.
He gets $1, actually. he's a unique character. But they got an option for the script. And what an option is basically somebody giving you money to say, I want the exclusive right to buy this movie for a period of time. So let's say it's 1 year. It's usually a year and a half. A year and a half. I'm going to give you $5,000 and I have the exclusive right to pay you, let's say $100,000 later on to buy your script. If the time runs out, you get the script back. So they option the script, but, and this is the thing that happens to most of us writers in the WGA world. A lot of times when they option the script, well, you don't get that much money for an option. Like I might get $5,000 for an option. What you do usually get is a rewrite fee. So they usually hire you to rewrite it. Mm-hmm. And the rewrite fee is actually, it could be $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, you know, something in there. And that's usually where you make your money. So it's usually like, yeah, the option's nice. But yeah, bring in that rewrite money. The rewrite money is what I want. And it kind of sucks because you got to rewrite and you got to take notes and things like that.
I'd never have guessed this.
But yeah.
Yeah, I've dealt with it, not at the level that he's given.
I would never have guessed that.
So you know, when
twice.
Yeah.
Whenever I've sold a script, I've never, I don't think, maybe one time I outright sold the script. So somebody actually gave me the purchase price. But usually I'm like, yeah, the movie probably will never get made, but give me that rewrite money. You know, so you have to go to work when you sell a script. So it's a weird celebration. It's more like, I got a job. It's not as much like
my movie's getting made.
Would you look at it too, Jamie? Yeah. I never got to ask you questions like this.
Sure.
Because I've experienced this. I'm not a WGA status writer, so not at the price levels that you have. But knowing what I know now about how the development process works, I see the opportunity for that initial rewrite as kind of a protection of ensuring the material goes in the direction that it needs to go without, because once you let it go, so many other people are going to get their hands on it and do what they do. So does that go into your thoughts of the rewrite, or do you listen to their notes?
No, I listen to their notes
because
here's the other side of that. If you don't, and I've sort of been on this world, if you argue too much and you don't do it, you only get that first rewrite.
Right.
So then they'll go to somebody else on the second rewrite. So you can't really be too protective or too, you have to be a good employee.
Yeah.
But
and I didn't mean I'm not that way. I was just kind of asking.
I mean, it's a good question, but really, you're a contractor. And if you don't put in the toilet in the weird room, like the guys say, they'll get another contractor to do it. So
listen to notes.
Listen to notes. You can defend them, but once they decide, here, this is my advice. This is what I say I always try to do. If I don't like something, I'll push back. If I really don't like something, I'll push back hard. But once it's decided what I'm going to do, I completely forget about my pushback and go all in with whatever awful idea they gave me. I am all in as if it's mine. And that's how I'd recommend doing notes. If you have to do the bad idea, if you lose the battle, go all in and try to make it the best thing, because that might be the movie that gets made. And maybe you can figure it out. Maybe you can make it work. So anyway, that's my piece of advice.
Dude, that's great. Thank you.
So anyway, they wrote the script. They optioned it to, I can't remember who it was. It was somebody that went out of business. Was it De Laurentiis or somebody?
It was something like that.
They always go bankrupt.
I saw De Laurentiis on the credits.
So yeah, it's something like that. There was a bankruptcy thing, and it sat on the shelf.
It sat on the shelf.
For a little while, yeah.
So they wrote it. The first draft.
It was Orion, right?
It ended up being Orion.
Yeah, it ended up being
there was
Orion.
There was a bidding war after a screening or something, and Orion got it. I don't know how much of a war it was. But the first draft of it... it actually had different characters. I mean, I heard that it had Babe Ruth and Charlemagne. And
also, it was about they were using a car.
That's right.
They're using the van. And this was after Back to the Future, obviously.
I think it was called something like Bill and Ted's Time Van.
Yeah,
or
it was
something.
Like, yeah,
it had a different
that's
a
very not okay name. Yeah.
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 And
yeah.
The one weird thing, I heard it actually, instead of Napoleon, it was actually Hitler at one point, which they changed.
So weird.
There's just some weird stuff like that. But anyway.
Which, like, in 1989, you might have been able to swing.
And
maybe.
You could see
Mel Brooks
how
made a career
simple,
of it.
Because he doesn't have any dialogue. It's
true.
All in. Yeah. You could see, I can imagine Hitler, like, at an ice cream place speaking German.
Right.
Yeah.
See
it.
As Bob pointed out, Napoleon, really, if you look in the history, wasn't such a nice guy either. You know, and Genghis Khan and all
Genghis
these other
Khan
things.
And Napoleon are arguably as awful.
Right.
Not numbers-wise, but... Yeah. As beings in history,
to make light of them is no different.
But this they
are not good guys.
Yeah. This movie has kind of a cartoony sincerity, that,
right?
You know, it mimics like a kids' movie almost.
It's like I always look at it kind of like a Magic School Bus type of deal.
Exactly,
it's
definitely.
Like that. Like you can go to terrible things, but you can kind of make light of it. We're learning, so it's culture. It's okay.
Yeah, Saturday morning cartoons.
Right, it's like a Muppets type of feel.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's essentially its history. It got the script was apparently a really hot script. It got passed around Hollywood after it was optioned, and people loved it and thought it was the funniest thing ever. And you know, it was a really popular script. It was a big script for them.
That's awesome.
So,
also kind of the surfer, Californian surfer dude thing was in
it
because
was the
of
peak of that. I think
Spicoli and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
I wasn't in these meetings, but I'm sure at some point they were like. Two Spicolis go on a time traveling adventure.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, just
I mean,
without drugs.
Mm-hmm. Point Blank is like an extension of,
it's like a more
sophisticated version of this character.
Right.
Yeah.
See, Keanu in his early career was pretty much serious Ted after
serious
this for a
Ted.
While. So
I almost wonder if he didn't do this movie, if his career trajectory would have been completely different.
Yeah.
He's talked about it extensively. Now he's overcome this. But
for
like 20, 30 years, he always was scared that the typecasting of this movie would follow him to the grave.
I think people thought he was.
Now.
Yeah.
I think people thought this is who he was 100%.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, he's proved himself. How many classic movies is Keanu actually in?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, like, he's proved himself beyond that. And now I love how about Bill and Ted is again.
Yeah.
Right.
He's re-embraced
embraced it.
And it's just wonderful. Yeah. So, Anyway, let's actually talk about the script.
No, but all
it's
that
so
stuff
weird.
Is great to
it's
talk
all,
about.
Yeah, it's all great. And honestly, like I said to you guys before, it's for me it's hard talking about a movie I consider pretty much kind of perfect.
Yeah.
It always is like weird, but let's talk about premise delivery and construction.
Yeah, so I think I wanted to bring up premise delivery because we haven't talked about it in a while. And I think why this movie lands so well, it's a really simple idea and they absolutely deliver on the promise of the premise as best as they possibly can. I mean, the second act is all fun and games. I mean, the
literally.
It's literally fun and games.
It almost borders, I'd say, on sketch.
Yeah.
I think it feels like a series of sketches to it, which
that are cohesive somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you could cut 50 trailers for this movie and put different stuff in them, and every one of them would be just as entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, that's how much it delivers on the premise.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wanted to bring up, you know, starting with like a blank whiteboard, how would you construct this movie based on its premise and show how they did that. You know, the same way that we've done before.
Really quick, what would you say the log line is? I mean, just...
When two flunking slacker wannabes rock stars have to pass their history exam using a time machine in order to bring peace and harmony to the universe.
Right.
Is that good?
You something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Because there is no villain. So there's no antagonist to throw in there.
You did a good job. It's always hard to do. I have a hard time doing log lines off the top of my head, but heroes, the two guys, goal to do a history report.
Yeah.
Stakes, if they don't do the history report, they will be broken up. He'll go to military school, and the world will end.
The future dies. The future, the good future that they were told exists.
It has a perfect log line construction, and then you just have to put marketing words around that circle of things.
Yeah. So when you're doing premise delivery, and I wanted to start before we go into the good way to do it. I had a client who gave me permission to talk about his script. Cool. So
really, okay.
Yeah, and I asked that he's a listener, and
thank you for
allowing.
Seriously, thank you for listening, sir.
Yes, thank you for listening.
Or lady, I don't know.
It's a sir.
Okay.
And I just did notes for this.
It's Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah, I wish. Dude, he would butcher my script.
He'd like our solo episode. He would like it.
Yes,
yeah.
And Jake, or John.
Yeah.
So I just did notes on this script a few days ago, and it has an incredible premise, and then the reason that it's not a good script is it abandons that premise after the first act setup.
I see that a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, and this, like Jamie said, you with your students, you see that a lot.
Yeah.
So
it's almost like sometimes with my students, it almost feels like they don't trust in it enough.
And you know? And that's exactly what he said to me when I gave him the notes.
Yeah,
he said,
I didn't trust in the premise. It's almost
that's
like they get
that you would start writing something and not trust
happens,
the premise.
No, it
happens
so
all the time.
Common.
It's so common. Okay.
So what
I would even say I did it early in my career.
Me too.
Like I get to page 50 and start being like,
do this process.
And you take
you have
a
to go
left
all
turn.
In on your idea.
That's, so and it's all about taking the time to say, okay, what is my premise? And so for instance, okay, for this script, I'm not going to say the exact premise, but it was a story that was perfectly designed to take place on a college campus. It was about purity and losing your innocence, this story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a genre. It was a horror. And it just was...
Not comedy, just horror.
It was a high-concept horror with a great title that was perfectly designed for a college campus and a group of college characters who are dealing with situations that they will be losing their innocence about.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The movie, the script opens on a college campus.
Okay.
Perfect, right? At a frat party.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the movie is all at the college. You meet these college characters who have these college problems, and you see that some of these characters are going to be dealing with losing innocence.
Right.
All the setup involves that. And then for the next 75% of the movie, he took the story out of the college campus to an abandoned asylum and never explored any of the loss of purity that he promised in this premise and never went back to the Greek setting that was perfect for his idea.
So it just became like a character horror.
It just became a bland horror movie that had nothing
to do with
his premise.
Yeah, right.
Right? He promised all this cool stuff. And then abandon it because he, like you said, and he told me himself, he didn't trust in his idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I see this so often.
It's one of the most common things.
Yeah,
yeah.
Where somebody comes to me and they have this idea that is so good. You're like, this is a movie. And then you read the script and there's nothing there that explores that great idea or does anything with it.
Right.
And so with this movie... It's all about answering the what if question. So you say, what if two slackers who are wannabe rock stars are entrust their future bring peace and harmony to the universe. But in order for peace and harmony to the universe to happen, they have to pass their history exam. Mm-hmm. What is that movie?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? And then so you start with, okay, well, what are the characters that you would mm-hmm. have in that mm-hmm. movie?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we're going to teach them history through time travel, we could meet Napoleon, right?
Right.
We
right.
could meet Genghis Khan. We could meet Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
We could meet, who did I miss?
Socrates.
Socrates. We could meet Billy the Kid.
Right.
So, like, they took the time to build this list of all the possible characters that they could interact with based on that specific premise.
Right.
And then what does that create? Okay, well, where is it going to take them? Right? The set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take them to France during the war. It's going to take
the
them to the Old West.
Yeah.
It's going to take them. And all of these settings were built based on how do we best answer the what if question
right.
in like an entertaining and manner.
The failure of that is almost the version where they get Billy the Kid and he comes back here and then we skip the time travel for the rest of it
yeah.
for a little while.
And I've read scripts here. Like yeah. that. It's like let's just abandon it. Let's just hang out with Billy the Kid. Right?
We
right.
did our time travel thing for 10 minutes. People got it and we're
right.
done. We're done time travel.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know.
And the time travel, what we're saying is the time travel is the fun in games too in this movie. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Yeah, and it doesn't abandon that
all
ever.
Of it.
Yeah, really.
But so they said, okay, how can we take these two slackers and put them into situations throughout history and
yeah.
make it fun and interesting based on the question of this the premise right. of this movie? And you can see the list building, and I'm sure, just like we've talked about in the past, some of that stuff they threw up on that board of ideas got put into the second movie because they didn't get a chance to do it in the first movie.
Right.
And that's what usually happens with these great movies that end up having sequels, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, a lot of the stuff that's
mm-hmm.
in
Temple of
Doom
right,
was premise delivery stuff that they didn't get to put
look
in.
Who's talking to was like that.
I'm no, sure just... I bet you
you know you
like,
say that
was...
but yeah I'm gonna
I,
say
I bet it
yeah.
was but you know and that you can ask yourself okay what are some of the lines that would show up in the trailer you know you got some great ones where he says strange things are afoot at the Circle
yeah.
K man you killed Ted you medieval dickweed
right,
you know
right,
these
right.
are the things that only would lines of dialogue like this would only happen in your specific premise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gotta mine it and like you've said this before. You
yeah.
suck the creative mm-hmm. juice. You
yeah,
just
it's
get,
the orange. You
yeah,
keep squeezing that
squeezing it, squeezing
squeeze
it, right?
It,
and like we talk about the Blake Snyder, the fun and games. I mean, this entire act two is fun and games. And I've read scripts, and I know Jamie has read scripts where the entire act two of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure would be a one page montage.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. they want to get that over with.
Right, just
yeah.
get it over with.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, no, that's the point of the movie.
Yeah, and that's really what they come to writers for.
Well, I think Jamie said it, I forget which, it was not that long ago in an episode, but you said, fun and games is kind of the reason movies exist.
Yeah,
like, it
yeah,
is. It's why
it's
we go.
It's why we go, like, to cheeseburger movies, to
cheeseburger
to
movies.
Genre
bringing
movies.
Back that
like,
cheeseburger.
Bringing back the cheeseburger
yeah,
last
yeah.
episode.
You're like, I want
fun and games is the reason we go
yeah.
to the movies
yeah,
for genre.
I know, like, William Martell book Secrets of Action Screenwriting, and I'm a big fan of William Martell, great guy, but he writes these, like, they're called blue books, but he also, you can get them on Kindle,
mm-hmm, 99 cents a piece.
That's my plug for Bill.
Thank
get,
you yeah.
his
Bill's
secrets,
great.
Secrets of Action Screenwriting was his first, and I think it was it's always the one I say I think it was the one
it's
he was
the
meant
only
to
one I haven't read
really mm-hmm. really it's great
and, don't worry I haven't read it
now that I think about this but he basically says he used to do, and I used to do this too, so when I read it, I was like, this makes total sense. But he just would start out his script, like maybe come up with the idea, and the first thing he'd do is just start writing a list of gags.
Yep.
You know, I mean, what are all the action sequences that happen in a movie about a suicidal cop, mm-hmm. like
right,
lethal
right.
weapon?
Yep.
And they'd start writing, well, he could handcuff a guy on a ledge, and we could, you know, and he'd just start writing all the possible ones.
So for this, it's like, if I had Spicoli going through history, what? Let me just write down
that,
a list.
Exactly.
Well, here's the
what
list.
Does that look like?
Yeah, here's
yep.
the list. And you would write down this movie.
And,
yep.
Right, yeah.
And I actually think the way to do it is do quantity, not quality. I think he might have in his book, I apologize because I haven't read it in a while, but I think he just tried to fill a page of paper.
Yep.
He just filled a page of paper. And I used to do the same thing. Like I used to give myself a crazy number. I think the key is don't give yourself 5. Give yourself 100.
Yep.
Because if you do 100... it'll let your mind, your critic, kind of stop, because you'll just start writing stupid stuff.
Yep.
And the stupid stuff might be the best stuff you can write.
It's also
yeah.
probably
yeah.
the most unique stuff.
It probably is.
It probably is, yeah.
And then I think what I've learned is you have to fold it back on itself. So we probably would come up with all the ideas. Bill and Ted in these fun locations, like what would they do in the Old West? What would we do in medieval times? But then you got it. This is the folding part. This is where the next level comes in. Mm. You have to say, okay, wait, but now I have historical figures in modern times.
Yeah.
So that's the next level. Yep. Of it.
It's I think exactly. I wrote in there.
That's perfectly the folding on.
One of the great things about this movie specifically is it's fish out of water.
Twice.
And then reversed. Yeah, it's like fish out of water, then fish out of water. Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
like,
exactly.
Which a lot of movies don't have a chance to do, ever.
No.
Yeah.
It's so pure and easy. And
right.
Yeah, so you just got to keep flip-flopping those things back and forth, and you got to get every squeeze of juice of that premise.
Right.
So you don't leave anything on the table. You don't want anybody to say, you know what joke you should have done? Because you want to cover every single one with your premise. You just want to eat them up.
And that's
I'm sure that Ed Solomon and Chris Madison got like, you should have put this historical figure in your movie. But you know what I mean?
And they're probably like, well, we were thought about
we
it.
We thought about that, yeah. Yeah. But I'm saying for years, they probably got, you know, you should have done Pol Pot. Oh, no.
A great exercise. This is, and I know he'll never listen to it, and that's fine. My partner Chris and I, Chris LaMartina, that's how I learned how to do this. We would do idea books as collaborators. We would come up with the idea together, and then I would just make a book, and he would too, where it's literally just random, like you said, gags. Okay, what are the gags that we could possibly put on this movie without even discussing it with each other? Just spitballing. What are the possible lines that could show up in a trailer or just show up in this movie based on this premise? What are the possible setbacks that a character could have in this situation? You know, like the antenna breaks, like on the time machine, like that was in the premise delivery construction.
Right.
You can just see it.
Right.
What are the possible victories and so that would deliver on the promise of the premise? The bubble gum and the pudding cans fix the broken antenna. You know, like that's only something Bill and Ted would come up with.
Good point.
You know. Mm-hmm. Ted's dad's missing keys, you know, like what a great delivery on the premise. Like, well, dude, just tell yourself in the future.
Absolutely.
And then they look behind the sign. Only Bill and Ted would come up with that. You know,
it only works with Bill and Ted.
It only works based on these
their demeanor
people.
And their intelligence level and their purity could do something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're not cynics, so they don't go, well, if we can do that, we already have won.
In
so
another
this whole movie's
movie,
over.
That doesn't work.
Right. It works because of the premise.
Imagine if Doctor Who started to do that every episode would be 10 minutes long.
Yeah, 10 minutes long. He's like, I'll just fix it with time travel later. And then you just forget. Yeah.
Yeah, like the message on the typewriter. Hey, dudes.
Right,
like,
right.
Now, duck. Like, these things only Bill and Ted would come up with as solutions, you know, and that's in the premise building. But that's what Chris and I would do. We would make these huge books full of
also,
all these gags.
Only Bill and Ted could actually befriend all of these figures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Only them.
Oh, they would get along with everybody, right? Yeah.
It's like you had to write the movie where these two guys are the only two guys in the universe that get along with everyone.
And that's a great question. Yeah. What are their relationships like? Yeah. What are the relationships like that you could put in this movie that would work and deliver on the promise of the premise?
Yeah, and they're also almost unaware of the dangers or the
totally.
Risks. They just grab Genghis Khan.
They're unskilled.
That's going to go into the arc section.
I was going to say, we're shown that they don't know history. So the fact that they do pick up Genghis Khan, they don't understand what that means.
Exactly. They don't have no idea.
They have no clue. Right?
Exactly.
But so it's just this movie is a fantastic example of how you can take just a really simple premise and squeeze all the juice out of it to make it as entertaining as possible. And
How much work goes into it. It's not just a dumb movie.
Oh, so much
work. This is a great genre. It's an extremely smart movie about dumb characters, which is like my favorite genre ever. It's my favorite genre. Sub-genre, but
Dumb and Dumber?
Yeah, like Dumb and Dumber, and a terrific movie about extremely stupid characters.
Full triumphant.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm just saying that because you get movies like this, and people dismiss it as stupid. And it's And it's like everything Jimmy just said, that there's so much thought put in to the stupidity.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, there's something about it, like even a movie like Galaxy Quest has its roots in this.
Yes,
you know,
right.
Absolutely. It's a little bit more refined version of that.
Yeah.
Just because it has more characters to focus on. It's got more work to do.
But I would say, too, with this premise delivery thing, so write your lists. You can do this almost right after you come up with a concept.
Immediately.
It's almost like the first thing like, you do. It's brainstorming.
Yeah.
This is the thing you stare at when you're writing.
It's exciting.
It does. Yeah.
It's one of the most fun parts because you're coming up, you're inventing all this stuff very fast.
Yeah.
Because you don't hit that wall. It's like, I'm a juggler, right?
Yeah.
So when you learn to juggle, the first year is fun because every day you learn a new trick. And then once you hit about the second year part and you get to like 5-6 balls, suddenly it takes like a year to learn every trick, you know? But I think the same is true in this phase. It's like when you get to this first phase, all your ideas are just flowing out. They're firing on all cylinders. And then you're going to hit a point where you're like a little bit more stumped, but that comes later
on. But you know what's great though? For this movie specifically, they not only had the Bill and Ted whiteboard, they had like the Genghis Khan whiteboard.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
You know, they had him going to a sporting goods store, and then they had Beethoven playing keyboards in the 80s.
And then they also had the time travel whiteboard.
Right.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
Just specific to time travel.
And you can just see it on every page, on every moment in the movie. The construction.
Yep.
I've used this phrase ever since you said it on this podcast. Just keep talking, Jamie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just keep talking. Just keep talking it out when you're building it. And you're guaranteed to come up with all that fun stuff.
Fun is a big word with this movie.
Oh, fun. It's just, dude.
I think that's
so
what sells
fun.
It beyond.
I got a smile on my face talking about it.
Right, right.
Stakes. Stakes.
Stakes are.
So, guys.
Stakes are really interesting with this one, I think.
So. It's a low stakes story when you talk about half of it.
It isn't. It actually creates life or death stakes.
Right.
Because they're going to be split up if they don't pass history. So them splitting up to them is life or death. It means they'll never have the band. Ted's going to go away to military school in Alaska,
right.
Which is like death. I mean, that's like death. But on top of that, there's this whole future will die stakes.
Yep.
So it really does pile on the stakes, even though the stakes are just passing a history test.
Exactly.
Okay, this is a weird thing to say, but once again, it's only Bill and Ted does this work with those type of stakes. I kind of also attribute it to like Paul Rudd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the genius stroke of Ant-Man is that when he's going to be in the next Avengers movie, when Paul runs around, everyone feels like no matter how dire everything is, it's kind of okay.
It's going to be okay.
If Bill and Ted are there, it's all going to be okay.
Everything's cool, man.
The future's going to die. Genghis Khan is right there with Napoleon. It's still,
everything's
going to
be okay. That's well put.
Like you have to write those characters properly or else this would be a disaster without Bill and Ted written properly.
I would also say this is a movie with low obstacles. Like most it's relatively
easy. I mean,
they get
handed the time machine and...
But I think you know what the obstacle is? Again, it only works with Bill and Ted because they're a little dumb. They're a little history challenge.
It's their challenge of their intelligence.
They might lose Napoleon at the mall. You know, most people wouldn't lose Napoleon, let Napoleon go with... What's his name? Declan or whatever.
Deacon.
Declan.
Deacon.
Deacon. Deacon stole my Easter basket.
They're not exactly.
Yeah, right.
They're not just going to let Napoleon go. Most characters wouldn't do that. They'd keep an eye on Napoleon.
Right.
But they would. So the obstacles for them to pull all this off is harder for them because of their attitude.
It's internal antagonism, their own kind of stupidity.
And that they're not even aware of.
A lot of the capture scenes are really just grab them.
Get them.
They don't make a meal of it.
They don't have to learn the value of that historical
moment. They don't need to learn the intricacies of time travel either. They just... do it.
The medieval times one probably is the one that is probably the most fully fleshed out. One of my favorite lines, put him in the Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden.
Excellent.
Right, yeah. Right, execute them. Which is
that's
a thing I would write. I would hope that if I was writing this movie, that's the one joke.
That's trailer, man.
That's trailer right there. Exactly. Yeah.
No, but I wanted to talk about stakes because we haven't talked about it much. And a lot of times you say it, what's at stake? I think a lot of people think they know what stakes are and how to use it. And stakes are, what are stakes? Stakes are what the character stands to lose if they fail, right? And there's tons of possible things that could be put at stake, but often that's how you understand the motivation why the characters are doing the things they're doing. But yeah. So many times I see a script that is like so well constructed. The dialogue's awesome. The structure's badass. Everything is fantastic about the script, except we've never been shown what's motivating them to do the things that they're doing. There's like no stakes presented for the entire movie.
Like this, if it ends without them completing the task,
right, it didn't need
it
to
doesn't
happen.
Matter.
Doesn't
yeah,
matter.
It doesn't
and
matter.
And so this movie does.
And it also points out that thing we talked about too in many episodes. The stakes often determine the why right now.
The why now.
Why does this have to happen right now?
This one has a great one.
This one has
the fate of the world.
This one has the fate of the world. This one has military school also. It's not just them breaking up. But
and puts that ticking clock on the back end that they have to do it by a certain time.
Right.
So it
and
has
they
to
shift
happen
and
now.
They change.
Rufus doesn't ever say why.
Dude,
I love that.
I love
he just
that
they
too.
Add in the ticking clock. And just you have to accept it.
Yeah.
There's, you know what I, there's just no just, other.
This is it. It makes it
simple. There's a ticking clock.
I broke it down. I wanted to kind of show how you could stack them, because often what I read, for anyone who's just listening to this for the first time, I read amateur scripts all day, every day, 5 days a week, and what I often read is just one thing at stake, and you can stack them. You can put like multiple 3, 4, 5 things at stake in the same scene, and they can change from scene to scene. And I wanted to show how in the first 10 minutes, Bill and Ted just stacks the stakes.
Sure.
So at the first scene, Rufus says, it's very clear, all this stuff, you'll see how clear it is. Rufus says, if I fail to get these two on the right path, the basis of our society will be in danger. Bam.
And in a direct address, fourth wall
direct
break.
Direct address, fourth wall break.
Yeah.
It works, though.
It
works.
No.
It's
just an extra little layer
they
that they
show
add.
It in the
yeah.
future.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so perfect. It's so clean, so easy. So we're in the future. We understand, like, his world and our future is at stake if Bill and Ted don't do this.
It's a conversation about tone right there.
You know, it's almost...
Right?
True.
I mean,
the
fact that Rufus can just direct address and you don't question it even
fourth
remotely.
Wall breaking.
Yeah. It's an interesting movie, stakes-wise, because it feels like they're doing extra credit to add the stakes. They work really hard to establish the stakes.
They do.
Extra credit, no pun intended.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they want to make sure you really understand what's happening in this movie. Yeah,
right.
And then in 6 minutes in, after putting on a sad display of history knowledge in class, Mr. Ryan says very simply and clearly, easy to understand.
Right,
it's really quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
Classroom.
If you don't get an A+, I will flunk both of you, which are education stakes, and for a teenager. I always look at education as their livelihood, right? So if they were adults, this would be like they might lose their job. But as teenagers, your job is going to school.
Right.
So there you go. So now you have on top of...
And then even I think on top of that, he says something. Whatever you do has to be really special.
Oh, yeah. He does say that.
So it
has to be good and unique.
So again, and obstacles for characters... The harder you can make the obstacles, the better. Because if they could just write a report, that would be one thing. But these guys that could barely write a report have to do something really special.
Well, they
that's a really good point, man.
It has to be an A plus.
And they can't write the report.
Yeah, they're incapable.
The only way they can is if there's this like solid gold, you know, golden ticket.
Yeah.
That's the only way this will work.
We see them
right.
trying to... write the report, jumping on the bed and doing all that stuff, and it
And then 8 minutes in, so the very next scene, 8 minutes, I'm just trying to show how they make them all clear. Bill says, Ted, we are in danger of flunking most heinously tomorrow.
Right.
So we got the education livelihood stakes restated. The very next scene is the Ted's dad scene, where Ted's dad says, if you fail history, you flunk out of school, and I will send you to Oates Military Academy. So we got the education stakes, we got the end of the future of the world stakes, and now we have Ted's freedom, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like, it's sort of an imprisonment, too.
Absolutely.
Right? So we'll talk about motivation, right? Mm-hmm. And how simple.
And that's also, we'll talk about that with arcs, but I also feel like that's a tiny bit of stakes too, is his relationship with his father.
That's good. Yeah. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, like that's
it's
at stake
true.
Too. His
relationship
with
his
father.
Dad.
Yeah,
he's got to prove his dad wrong.
He has pretty.
I didn't
really
think about that.
Yeah.
That's really true.
Yeah.
The very next scene, so we're still not even 10 minutes in. We're getting all this motivation, understanding. Bill and Ted are discussing the previous conversation with his dad. and the threat of military school in Alaska. And Ted says, we gotta pass. Otherwise, there's no more band. So it's like, right. Shit.
Right.
Okay. The end of the universe. They're going to flunk out of school. Ted's going to end up in Alaska. And worst of all, there's going to be no band.
Now, I'd love to point out something that I absolutely love about this movie and in the script is that they establish at the very open that the thing that the two of them think they need to make the band work, which we've already been told is the most important thing in the history of mankind, is Eddie Van Halen. Yeah. And when they finally get their magic wand, they don't even remotely think to use it for that.
No,
that
know,
never comes
awesome.
Up. And it's not, I don't feel like it's lazy. It's just them.
No, they it's never, who they are. They would never figure that out.
They never would think. Yeah. They would never. Wait, we could just use this to make the band better instead of going and doing all this stuff to make, you know, the Rube Goldberg machine of our lives. They didn't think they could just become.
Just go. Yeah.
Yeah. Just learn. Just use it to be. Yeah. Go get them.
That's
just
a good point.
Get
them. Yeah. You know, you could see a different movie where that is all about. What it is.
Yeah, like, screw the future.
We're going to make a band. Let's go get Mozart and Eddie Van Halen and this and that.
Yeah,
that could be a great movie.
That would be a great movie. Then trying to figure out. That's like School of Rock with time travel.
Or it's kind of like.
They make their own damn Yankees out of history.
Dude, that's great.
Yeah, right.
Let's write it.
Right.
let's do it about baseball.
Let's do the premise delivery.
They build their expendables, pretty much.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's awesome. So anyway, you see in the first 10 minutes, all of those education. So, and that one is ambition fulfillment stakes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they have an ambition, and if they fail, they're going to lose that ambition. That's like another thing that you
their dream
on.
Is
their
gonna
dream.
Die.
Yeah. The dream is going to die. So we're 10 minutes in, and we have all of these things that we understand that's motivating them. And it's such a simple movie, and yet look at all of those intricate details of these characters and what's motivating them to do it.
Right.
So I just think it's a really pure, like you said in past, like with Galaxy Quest, these things are really easy to learn from. It almost mm-hmm. plays like a Disney movie. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's like greatness in its simplicity.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Less is more, all that.
Less is
same
more.
Crap you can say on a Christmas card or whatever. Put it on a cat poster. It's right.
I'm gasping.
No, it's okay. You just read like three pages of stuff, Jimmy.
That's how we roll sometimes.
Right. Well, ticking clock mechanism.
Yeah, it kind of ties right into it.
It kind of ties what you said. I mean, they literally make up their own rules for time travel, so that is thrown out the door, I think, with him explaining that.
Yeah, it seems like, I guess in this universe, time is consistent, so they have to get back by noon. So if they take an hour to go back in time, they have to kind of, you know.
In a weird way, it's the only time travel movie written to address the actual time that the traveler experiences.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
which
right.
is
perfectly.
Something that most time travel movies don't. Like, Marty McFly is, like, always going to be, like, 3 weeks older than he is.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, no one ever addresses that. This sort of is, like, Rufus going,
that's what matters.
You only get, like, 2 days, and then you got to start living your life again.
The reason that I wanted to talk about it, not only because we haven't talked about it much, but for a movie that's about time, it doesn't really have that many mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, like Mission Impossible, Mission Impossible Fallout has like 25.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This one has like 5.
Yeah.
What's the David Mamet why now rule?
It literally
beyond
is
beyond the just, premise.
No, it's just literally every scene. Why does this scene happen?
Why
now?
Does this happen?
Why is this happen?
That's all.
So the premise has a great why now question, but also I feel like if you answer that why now, that creates like its own mini urgency within the scene, probably. Yeah.
I usually it's kind of weird. Usually the why now is a cause effect thing, but I think because this one's episodic, that's why we need the ticking clock.
Yeah,
because it's not like getting Billy the Kid then necessitates getting Genghis Khan necessitates. Yeah. They could get them in any order.
They create when they go to get Billy the Kid, they add in the mini plot.
Right.
When he's that he's being, everyone wants to kill him.
Right.
And they gotta get
him
out of there. It's a new ticking clock every time they arrive.
Yeah.
And you can, they can be reset.
They're
going to
be executed
onto each other.
Medieval England. They have to get,
There's urgency within each sequence to do it. Yeah.
I always thought the one scene that when I watched this time, I was like, the Napoleon scene's kind of odd. They just stop there, look at a war, and then go back.
Yeah.
Well, that's a
budget
thing.
They run away.
Yeah. They look at, it's War and Peace.
War Clip.
War and Peace.
Yeah, and then they just, they couldn't afford that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny, because it's just like Rufus showing them that they can go back in time, so they accidentally pick up Napoleon.
Yeah, it's kind of like, oh, he's there.
Yeah.
But it works, man, it works. No, but I tracked how, because I was fascinated. I was like, when I watched it at first, because I watched it twice for the podcast, and the first time I was struck by how little we cared about the time. It's that we weren't reminded that often. And so I was trying to see what actually this story does to make you feel urgency. So the first one, it's set up right from the beginning, which is the deadline. The deadline of the final project tomorrow. So now we know we have 24 hours to get all of this done. So 24 hours to save history.
Clock's always ticking in San Dimas, which doesn't make sense, even with time travel, but it does because the movie just says it does.
That don't bother me
at
all.
You just take
I get that rule. You just have to tell it, and we accept it.
And then the second one is Rufus tells Ted, make sure to wind your watch. Or Ted tells Ted.
Yeah.
They both tell him.
Yeah.
Make sure to wind your watch.
Yeah.
Right. And then the third ticking clock mechanism is the functionality of the booth starts fucking up.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to get all this stuff done before the booth falls apart. That's another, and it's visual. We can see it. Like, it starts falling apart, and it keeps falling apart, and the more it falls apart, like, the less opportunity they have to achieve the goal. Because, like, it's important to a lot of times people just use clocks, but you can use, you know, we're going back to Back to the Future. You can use it's the photo, you know, every time something happens in the story, somebody disappears from the photo.
Also, there's it's never made clear, but the circuits of time even start to break down a little bit. Remember
the
whole loop
circuits
thing?
Of time.
Yeah, they start to they lose control of what
because
they're doing.
Because the booth is falling apart.
Because the booth
apart.
Is falling
apart.
Yeah,
and you can see, and that's visual. Like, nothing needs to be
it's
said.
It's visual, yeah. It's
and we in the audience feel like, oh, shit, they got to get it all done before.
For this thing that kills them, pretty much, yeah.
And then we find out that, because we haven't been told what time the assembly starts, then we find out after they fix the booth, they have a new clock, which is the assembly starts at 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have a new clock. Oh, shit, they got to get all this done by 1:30, right?
They got to, And then they got to go find Napoleon.
Then they have to go back and get Napoleon by 1:30.
Right, yeah.
And then you find out, but then the clock changes again. You learn that Bill and Ted are specifically scheduled at 2:45. So, like, okay, they got another hour, right? Like,
and then the arrests.
And then the arrests fuck that up and delay them. And then another mechanism that they use is every new student that comes on stage tells us that they have less time. So they don't even need to show the clock. They just show another student, and you're like, oh, shit, they're getting closer and closer. So it's a countdown, but it's not an actual clock. It's just a human being on stage.
Closer, insert of the pad of the teacher, and he's like circling it. Yeah,
for clarity. Yeah, scratching out. So once again, it's not an actual clock, but it still tells us that that time is counting down. So, you know, that's it. That's not that many. What was that, like six?
No, but they're sweeping, though.
Yeah, they're sweeping.
They kind of cover the whole thing. And the movie's pretty light.
Yeah.
It doesn't need that.
Because, again, in between the seams, it's kind of sketch. It's just like, let's do this sketch, let's do that sketch. And then these things just kind of tie it together for the audience. The audience knows that we're going somewhere. We have a trajectory.
Right.
We kind of feel... We can internalize the end coming.
You know, the original ending that was filmed is different. You know, you guys know that, right?
I didn't know that.
No, the original ending, it ends at prom. And they take the princesses to prom. Yeah, they actually made action figures of that ending. And
what
stuff.
Was the was that like the
epilogue?
The epilogue.
I've never seen it, obviously, but it ended at prom, and then they decided they need a much more grandiose ending, so they actually filmed the ending that we know and love.
I love that ending. Yeah,
and it seamlessly is inserted in there somehow. And but it originally ended at prom.
Okay.
Which is odd because the setup they must I think they refilm stuff at the beginning too.
They must have.
They must
there's
have.
Nothing in there.
Yeah, it's like
to
airtight.
Warrant
so.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, when I rewatched it this time, the princesses are a little tacked on.
Yep.
You know,
I agree.
But
I don't remember.
Well, their love interests back then were kind of like standard. You had to have love interests.
They like meet them one time and then they come back and it's
says,
you know it's not like
I'm
older.
In love.
That's the princesses are more character work.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the two of them.
Yeah.
You need a love interest. And yeah. Them finding
this will not pass the Bechdel test.
It does not. Yeah. No.
Product of its time, though.
Right.
Joan of Arc talks to someone else.
There's two.
In another life.
Missy talks to Joan of Arc. No, I don't.
And there's one homophobic joke.
Yeah, but that's a product of his time,
It's a product of his time. Alex Winter said that will not be repeated in the third one.
Yeah,
he knows. He's,
But yeah, so it's another easy to track, easy to learn from ticking clock examples to create urgency for Bill and Ted to achieve their goal.
Mm-hmm. And in that, let's talk about the villains that are...
Yeah, so it's an interesting...
Who's the
antagonist in this movie?
It's low obstacle. I think time is the antagonist. Really,
that's,
you know,
awesome. I love that.
It's erased.
I mean, you could say Ted's
that's
dad.
That's like an intangible.
Ted's
I
dad
love
is
that.
Kind of an antagonist. But
yeah, yeah. They're
like
low.
He is going to do the thing that will destroy the future without knowing.
They run into obstacles like the guy who's going to execute them.
Yeah.
You know, Billy the Kid's enemies, you know, things like that. They run into obstacles.
Like you said, it's low obstacles.
But they kind of do, they change from sketch to sketch. Even Napoleon, finding Napoleon, that the obstacle is where is he? It's kind of the mystery of it.
Yeah.
You know, things
it's
like that.
It's really low. Yeah.
They're very low and they change a lot. But time is the ultimate thing. They're running a race, essentially. They're running a race to get all these things to be on stage at whatever
and
time, 2:45, 2:30.
Do you guys think that the
I love that.
The lack of like
I never
a,
thought
the,
about
the
that.
Lack of a snidely that, whiplash here is what lets the movie be fun and games kind of. You know what I mean? Is that the fact that we know the end goal and we know the premise and they can have fun in the middle because there's no, you know, twirling mustache villain.
I think it would be a completely different
right,
movie.
Right. It would be the sequel has the villain.
I was gonna say.
Yeah, the sequel has the villain. The sequel's a different movie. It's completely different movie.
Yeah,
but this is allowed to be like that because there is no one pressing them. And
it just really stuck out to me that
there's no one chasing them through time.
There's no one trying to stop
them.
There's no one who wants to bring destruction and chaos to the universe.
There's no one. Yeah, there's no one that wants to destroy the future.
Yeah,
which I bet is something they talked about and saved it for the sequel. You know, like we said. Yeah, they saved it for the sequel.
Maybe in the premise delivery, they were like, "Let's save it.
We don't need this. Time is enough. Time is enough." Right.
It's kind of not having a villain because I really love the second movie probably even more than the first, but because it does have the villain, it does have those stakes and there's kind of even more to it. It has a bigger budget too and things like that.
Crazier.
Yeah, it's crazier.
It's insane.
This movie almost feels like that's part of the joke is like, it's kind of about nothing. There's not a lot of obstacles and that's part of the joke.
This movie is more in keeping with Bill and Ted themselves.
Right.
Like the tone of the movie is also them.
It's kind
like,
of a slacker of a movie.
Whereas the sequel is like, let's put these guys in a much darker situation where they're actually being forced into it. Yeah. Against their own will. And they have adversaries, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, and they're so good they turn some adversaries to their side.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
this would be the second one.
This would be the second movie. That's and the great sequel is something that's markedly different
ups
than the first.
The ante.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arcs is Arcs. I want to talk about Arcs.
That's why I brought this up.
Yeah, because we've talked a little bit about Back to the Future before, and I think one of the amazing things about Back to the Future is that Marty doesn't really have one.
Right.
Yep.
And it's odd that this is also an 80s time traveling movie that's really popular. And I also kind of don't feel like Bill and Ted have them either.
Yeah.
They have like arcs in what they accomplish.
Yeah.
But they they are still Bill and
still
Ted.
Bill and Ted.
And there that's why they're great is because Bill and Ted cannot be changed. Bill and Ted's greatness affects everyone around them, right, Jamie?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
They're Superman, pretty much.
I've even read, I don't know if it was an Ed Solomon quote.
Love to hear what Ed says about it.
But I think I read that he thinks they don't have an arc. He said, they're characters that didn't have an arc. But maybe it wasn't him. Maybe it was like Alex Winter or somebody. I have a memory of reading an interview
if they had an arc, it would be a different movie. They wouldn't be iconic.
So I was trying to dig this time when I watched into an arc, and I'll tell you what I came up with.
Okay.
And then I'll say
it. I can't really formulate it. But they do go from people that think getting Eddie Van Halen is the key to the band to people that actually think it's time to put in the effort and play the instruments. Yeah. It's not exactly beat for beat learned. Like you could see a version of it where they learn from the history people. Mm-hmm. And that's why like they learned Napoleon had to do it this way. So they put it together. They don't do that in this movie. But
you're not wrong. They're not different people though.
They're not different people.
Yeah.
Right.
But It feels like the type of thing that is an art. Maybe we should learn to use these instruments. Right. They're a little more mature. There are people that actually pulled off a great history.
Yeah, they did. They did.
And they didn't start as that.
They didn't slack their way through that project.
Right.
No, they tried.
And they actually seem like they learned something, like, let's learn to play the instruments.
Yeah.
So I think there is an arc. I don't know that it's not that I'm not saying this in a negative way, because I as much believe what you said, Bob. I didn't think you're disagreeing with me.
No, I agree with that too.
I don't think this arc is necessarily quote unquote earned, or it's beat for beat spelled out,
or even intentional.
Love to hear what he says.
Yeah.
You basically said everything I was going to say. I feel like it's not earned, but it does have this feeling of thoughtless to wise.
Yeah.
And it does have this feeling of people who talk the talk and then learn to walk the walk, because there's a clear bookend of those garage scenes where it's very intentional that they're like, let's get Eddie Van Halen and let's do the video. And then in the bookend version of that, they're like, dude, forget about Eddie Van Halen. Let's learn to play instruments ourselves and let's figure this out. And that's like a clear change, you know?
It is a change. I guess sometimes with arcs, I view it more as a personality thing.
Okay, I got you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But here's what I would say, though.
You're not wrong. I'm not disagreeing.
It's not profound.
It's not. No. They learned a lesson. They didn't learn to be different. Yeah. But
like
that?
A cartoon episode.
It's a cartoon, right.
But I would say this, though. Remember the two arcs, and we added a third. The two arcs are, one, learn to be more confident. Two, have more empathy, care about others.
Yeah.
Confidence, I guess.
I think it's confidence.
Yeah,
confidence. I think they start off as people that maybe didn't have the confidence.
As they have the capacity for. Through
pulling off this very difficult project, they gain confidence that maybe they can pull off the next project. That's kind of how I
don't think the movie
perfect,
is like
Jamie.
Hung on that at all.
Yeah, nah.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's there.
Yeah.
It's like there. Yeah. It's like fine.
It does feel like the end of a Saturday morning cartoon episode. Yeah, like, hey, we can play these instruments now. You know, I'm not saying that as a negative thing.
None of this is negative. I wrote on here like goals instead of arcs kind of thing. And that's also
But I do
a little
think
bit,
of them as one
you know?
Character mm-hmm. in this one at least.
Yeah.
The only weird split between them is the dad character.
Yeah. And the mom.
And the dad.
She's not your mom.
Yeah. The dad.
Right. Yeah.
The dad does arc to have appreciation for Ted. And maybe he can pull this stuff off, I guess, in the end, a little bit.
Well, he's obviously impressed.
He's not sending him to military.
He has no faith in his son at the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. And he has faith after the presentation, assumedly.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. I guess.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we're kind of like, it could be both. It could be that they.
Hopefully
did
they learn that the princesses need.
I think
you
said it perfectly. Yeah. They have the. This sign of sort of presence of a change, but it's not really earned.
Well, I think because.
But it's not asking to be earned.
No, it doesn't need to be.
This is where they stay the same, is that I'm not entirely sure that them deciding to learn to play the instruments is going to mean anything. You know, I don't know what their definition
is. Outside
of
Rufus telling them it will, they have no proof. Yeah. Right.
That's a good call.
I can't imagine that they're going to go and sign up for lessons or anything. You know, they're going to figure it out their own way.
Right.
Like, what if I hit this string this way? Or, you know,
they do get better.
Right. It's not a movie about arcs.
No, it doesn't need to be. But it was fun to talk about it, you know.
Which is also like, that's kind of like the magic of this movie.
You don't need it.
The fact that you can write the movie without a villain and without arcs, and it's still amazing and
beloved
and great, and it works and it's fun. It's like, that's an incredible amount of craft right there.
It is.
I would even say, and this isn't something I've ever voiced before or thought before.
Ooh.
No, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, you're going to be like, obviously, but it has a little bit of a satirical nature. It's spoofing and satirizing a certain genre. And I think even that arc, like, maybe we'll learn to lose. I think it's sort of...
It's almost a wink-wink to that.
It's sort of nodding to the tropes of that, where they're kind of... You know what I mean? I mean,
right off the bat, the phone booth is a satire of Doctor Who. So it's like, stuff like that, I mean, you just kind of set it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sequel ups that satiric ante tenfold, too. So, yeah. Is there anything else we have to talk about this?
No, I think we're good.
Joyful experience.
It's a joyful experience. Like... in a cynical world, this I could see this movie being torn apart now if it came out now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That Alex Winter himself has said, like, the third one will not lose that edge of being uncynical.
Oh, that's great.
Well, I mean, they wrote it. They've been writing it for how long? Like,
yeah.
Matheson and Solomon have been writing for how long? Because, but it is a weird thing to think about them making another one of these now.
The world is so cynical.
So cynical. Well, you know, because everyone would just
the
like,
snark.
The time travel doesn't work. And you're like, oh, man, but, that's not what this is.
Yeah.
Like,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
I think that kind of satirical nature, though, protects them to a certain extent
from that a little bit.
It's like, hey, this is a joke on that.
Jamie, there's a big difference between 89 and 19. You know,
everybody thinks everything's the same. Like, they think jokes are the same.
They put it all in one box.
Everything's the same, and it's not. But I would also say, here's the weird part I would say. If I was writing that, where I'd be scared.
The third one now?
The actors are older, and it's hard to do an old people story that's not a little cynical, looking back. So that's the weird part. Like, those two guys being the same guys when they're in their 50s or whatever they're going to be, that's the part I'd have trouble writing.
But
like,
I'm excited to see, since it didn't come true.
They're
a failure.
They've said for years that they thought, they've been thinking about that premise for years, though. They've said that Bill and Ted being old is hilarious to them. So I'm sure they've got a whiteboard filled with all the jokes. What are these guys 20, 30 years later? What are they like?
Definitely.
What is their life? Yeah. You know? So, yeah.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
The Dark Knight of the series.
Oh, man, I hope not. That would destroy
it's
me.
It's not going to be.
Everything Ed Solomon says on Twitter is just amazing.
Yeah. Frank Miller's Bill and Ted.
God, Zack Snyder's Bill and Ted. Well, hopefully when it gets made, it's the director of Galaxy Quest. So
fantastic.
I mean, could you ask for anything more perfect?
Mm. Ivan Reitman.
Not now.
I don't know.
Not now.
1984. No. Ivan Reitman.
Sure, fine, but not now. Anything else, guys? Anything else?
Nah. What'd you guys learn?
I mean, God, I feel like everything was learning this episode. This is all learning.
I mean, the premise delivery thing stands out for me for this one. You know, write those lists. Start writing those lists. Put it on paper. Write a big list. Don't think too much.
Yeah.
Just write.
Have fun with it.
Yep.
Keep talking. I learned, because you made a great point, that you can have a high concept story with no villain and no arc. And it can still be awesome.
Excellent. I know.
It can still be excellent.
I learned, even though I probably subconsciously know it, I feel like that's this whole show for me, that this movie is pretty much fun and games the movie. I didn't ever really think of it like that, but that makes perfect sense.
Yep.
And that also kind of explains why people just find joy in it.
Yeah.
Because it is literally that. Most movies are like, here's a page, and then this
it's
is like,
the one
here's
page
20
montage
pages
stretched
of,
out
yeah.
for... At least 75 of the 90 minutes.
It's, the one thing we didn't even talk about, this movie is crazy quotable. It's like
the
one of
dialogues.
The most quotable movies.
I mean, be excellent to each other. Those guys have said if that's like the one thing that they put out in the world, they can, you know, everything else is kind of inconsequential. Right. Yeah. All right.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
We did it.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy, available only on Thundergrunt.